With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live.
This is the Malcolm Roberts Show
on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to the Malcolm Roberts Show. My name is Jason Olborne, and I am filling in for the Senator as prior commitments mean that I'm the privileged one who gets to interview one of the shining lights in the medical profession, Dr. Philip Altman, who will be on the program shortly to continue his discussion of a paper that he presented on behalf of Malcolm's summit recently, the COVID summit. And this particular paper that Dr. Altman has written is the most comprehensive report you'll ever see or hear from, and it will be terrific that that Philip will be able to be here and go through that in some great detail and explain exactly what's going on here. This is the story, certainly the medical story of all time, of all time. Now, just last week, my wife came home. She went to the public library, and she came home with a bunch of DVDs, and she said to me, "I found a movie I think you'll like." I said, "What is it?" She goes, "It's called 150 milligrams, and its title, well, the inverted commas link was, it's the Erin Brockovich in lab coat story. And it tells the story of a whistleblower, a French lung specialist called Irene Frachon, who based this on her best-selling memoir, and it was particularly that she discovered in her seeing of patients that the drug Mediator, which was a diabetic, it was a weight loss drug given to diabetics, and had been used for 30 years. And in France, the doctors had just missed what had been going on, and she'd found out that it was causing heart valve disease. And so she got it to a certain level and realized that she needed to get some other scientists in who were better at doing these studies. And so she went about going through this process. And the discovery was that it was causing up to 70% of all heart valve disease. And so she went through the process of formalizing a study and getting it out there. And she ran into roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And the movie is a brilliant expose of the system and how the system can throw up roadblocks, et cetera, et cetera. To cut a long story short, the drug has been banned. It was banned in 2009. It was the result of thousands of deaths, and people only as late as last year were starting to be compensated for it. And what it does is shows you the difficulties that we face when we challenge the system, we buck the system, and it's very, very important that we understand this. So by having Dr. Altman here today to explain in the age of COVID what he has discovered is truly astonishing, but not unprecedented, and that's the main thing. It's just that it's the biggest case ever. Now, we are going to talk throughout, and statistics will no doubt come up. And I just want to present another perspective before we bring Philip on the show. And it's something that's going to relate to today. And it's the work that I've been doing over the last couple of years, comparing statistics, not just in Australia, but Australia against other nations. And the one that I was always fascinated with was Nigeria. And the reason that I was that because Nigeria has a huge, the biggest in the world, in fact, a malaria problem. And anti-malarial drugs are recognized that some of those drugs happen to be hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. So the first thing I did when I looked at it was figure, well, if they're already taking these drugs, then maybe they've already got a preventer for COVID because people were using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. But ironically, in Nigeria, they weren't using either drugs. They're not actually recognized for those for malaria. They have a whole different set of drugs. So then I thought, well, okay, well, maybe anti-malarials in general have this type of effect. So I compared the notes. Now, in Nigeria, you've got 200 and something million people, about 206 million, about eight times the size of Australian population. And they were having around about the same amount of cases and around about the same amount of deaths. This is up until the end of 2021. Now, of course, this was characterized by the switch to the Omicron virus, which a variation which came out of South Africa. And so it stood to reason that it would get itself into Nigeria and there'd be a great comparison. Well, what I did was in relation to some statistics that that Philip has used in his report dated from February 15 of this year, where Australia at the time had 2,639 death registrations. This is on page 8 of his report. I went back and compared that to Nigeria to start the number comparison at that point. So Nigeria at that point, it had 3,141 deaths, so a little bit more than Australia, but population 8 times the size. So I fast forward until today, Australia's deaths have gone from 2,639 to 15,221, an increase of 12,582 deaths. In the same time in Nigeria, the deaths in that country have risen from 3,141 to 3,155. That's just 14 deaths in 7 months of this year compared to Australia's 12,582. So what does that mean in terms of comparison? In that time, 28% of Australia's population has had COVID, and in Nigeria, less than 1/200th of 1% have had COVID in that country, in that poor African country. If you compare then, for every one death in Nigeria, Australia has 899 deaths officially to COVID, 1 to 899. The death rate in Australia today is 1 in 584, so it's virtually trivial, meaningless. And in Nigeria, 1 in 814. Australia, as we all know, have been highly vaccinated, 95% double jabbed in the adult population, and then going down for third and fourth. Nigeria, less than 12% of that country have been vaccinated. Tells you a lot, doesn't it? For all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals and fundraisers happening near you, then visit the What's On events calendar on the TNT Radio website at tntradio.live. Stay in touch on TNT Radio.
It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make American great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA, it's just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Dr. Philip Altman is a Bachelor of Pharmacy with honours, a Master of Science and a PhD. His reputation precedes him with over 40 years at the forefront of medical testing in this country, and he is the star report writer of this incredible report called The Time of COVID. Dr. Altman, welcome back to TNT Radio and The Malcolm Roberts Show.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
What a delight it is to speak to you again, Philip. Our last time I had you on my show, you just open the mind, and some of the things that you're able to draw together makes everything that people, you know, have a feeling of a gut feeling or a suspicion or a doubt, and you just stitch it all up and you provide the evidence, and it provides so much reassurance that we know that we cannot be gaslit anymore. On the contrary, we are now building an arsenal of information that is impenetrable, and it is only a matter of time before the great house of cards will indeed collapse. And the purpose of today's program, the 2-hour show that we've got together, is to explore in further detail where you left off last time when you were discussing on this particular show The Time of COVID, this 100-odd page report that you put together with the help of some legal eagles, some superstars as well. So I'm handing the floor to you a little bit because I wasn't privy to the earlier show. Would you like to recap perhaps a little bit, or would you like to just continue on from where you left off? Because this is going to be a 4-part series for people to go back using the podcast system to listen to everything that that you put together. But I'd like to give you that choice.
Well, we can just continue on from where we left off. Perhaps that's the best way to do it. But before I begin, just a brief comment. That presentation that I gave on the 10th of September was really different from the presentations that I would normally give. I normally drill down on the technical side, gets very technical, a lot of statistics and numbers and so forth. And I've been arguing from that point of view for a year and a half now, right? And it doesn't seem to get me anywhere. And so I decided to go on the 10th of September, what I would call post-data, right? That's looking at the big picture. So what we're talking about now in terms of my presentation is really the big picture. And Jason, your introduction is a really good example of how people aren't looking at the big picture. I mean, how many times have you heard one of our senior health bureaucrats or someone from the TGA comment or take notice of anything that's going on overseas that looks like it could be really interesting. You mentioned Nigeria. There's lots of countries in Africa that give you good examples. Niger is another one. Niger is a very, very poor country in Africa, as African nations go. It has about the same population as Australia. And they had a vaccination rate of somewhere down near 10 or 12%, right? It was really low. And yet they hardly had any COVID-19 cases. Why is that? And I mentioned this in my speech on the 10th of September. Why doesn't someone in the TGA stick their head up and say, hang on a minute, there might be something going wrong here. What is this? Are they keeping accurate statistics, or is there something here that we should really know? And I don't believe that people are asking the right questions. The key to it, in terms of Niger, of course, is they use ivermectin almost on a routine basis across the nation. But of course, that's been ignored. And that's been the trend throughout Africa, too, with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. So they haven't suffered as much as we have, despite the hundreds of billions of dollars that we've thrown at the problem. These poor African nations have seemingly done better than we have, and it's a real question.
They absolutely have outperformed the Western world on every metric. And if people are uncertain, I would suggest, now we all use different statistics websites. I tend to favor Worldometers, but people use many other ones. But one of the easiest ways to do a genuine comparison, Philip, is to simply compare Israel with Palestine. Because you've got one that's considered a first world nation. It was the most vaccinated in the beginning and exclusively signed a vaccine deal with Pfizer, whereas Palestine was under-promised the vaccine. It was only about 27% took the vaccine there. So you're well less than half the rate. Now, Israel's around about 10 million, 9.5 million population, Palestine around about 5.5 million. So you proportionate the stats. Palestine defeats Israel on every single metric that you can look at. Cases, hospitalizations, deaths, Palestine beats Israel. It should not be the case, and yet it is. And so that is a really interesting way for the average home statistics student. Now, everyone studied statistics and mathematics in year nine at school, so it's not like we don't know what we're talking about. What I tried to do when I got involved with this was to just distill it down to simplicity. I applied a personal Occam's razor to all of it, and I said, if I can't make head or tail of this, I'll leave it alone. But on the contrary, what I found was how easy it was to determine the absolute risk rate. And the very first statistic I was able to work out two or so years ago was that we had a survival rate of that no one was talking about of 97.3% across the board, 0 to 100, which meant that 1 in 43 were dying at the time with no access to any treatment. And of course, you weren't allowed to even mention hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. If you got diagnosed with COVID in the early stages here in Australia, what they said to you was, go home and wait until you get really sick and then call the ambulance. There was not even the use of Panadol or Nurofen or liquids or, you know, chicken soup, for heaven's sake. There was nothing. Yeah. They took all the ads off TV. They didn't mention echinacea, olive leaf, any of the usual cold and flu remedies that would give you a little bit of an immune boost. It was all forgotten, except McDonald's was open and the bottle shop drive-through was also open. That was the remedy that our Prime Minister presented to us, who should be ashamed of himself sitting in semi-retirement today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And really, when you think about it, there is a bill which is going through the Queensland State Parliament now, which will essentially censor all doctors if it gets through. All doctors will be censored by law, which will mean that your doctor, if this bill passes soon, will not be able to give you their honest opinion about your particular circumstances or case. They must follow the narrative provided by the government. For example, I know the government right throughout this pandemic up until recently have said that natural immunity didn't count, right? And if this law goes through and you approach your doctor and you have natural immunity, you've had COVID, and you ask that doctor, should you get vaccinated despite the fact that you have natural immunity, and that's been proven now to be very effective going forward, probably much more effective than the vaccines, that doctor will not be able to tell you the truth that you don't need the vaccine, because they could lose their license if this bill gets through. And if it gets through in Queensland, it's going to spread to Victoria straight away and then the rest of Australia. And that must be a concern to everyone in Australia, because it means that you no longer can get an honest opinion from your doctor. Your doctor will be frightened to give you an honest opinion of your particular circumstances. It's a principle in medicine that every person should be treated as an individual, and the government is not doing it. That's typified by that recommendation in COVID. It was the first time that a serious infection was not treated as early as possible. They said, go home, as you said, Jason, go home and hopefully you'll get better. And most people did get better. Go home and hopefully you'll get better. And if you don't, we'll send an ambulance, right? Yeah. I mean, what sort of advice is that? And if that's the official government advice going forward, Jason, we're all in big trouble.
Well, we certainly are, Philip, because what makes it even tougher is that Queensland doesn't have an upper house or a Senate or a House of Review. So in other words, if this is put up by the government of the day, it will pass, which is absolutely tragic. And as you said, it will now disseminate through the country. So we are never, ever, ever in a space where we can take a breath and breathe a sigh of relief. On the contrary, we have to be vigilant with all of it. And the best way we do that is to educate as many people as we can, as simply as we can. And that's what we're going to set out to do. We're going to pause for a quick break. When we come back, we're going to sink our teeth into Philip Altman's work. It's brilliant. And you will agree that this was the hour and a half now going forward that you're glad you never missed. This is TNT Radio.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
People say, this is crazy. Why is Joe Biden doing this? It makes no sense. Well, first of all, Joe Biden's doing nothing. Joe Biden's lucky if he can make it to the podium. He's not running the country. The people running him are the ones running the country. His chief of staff, Valerie Jarrett, all of Obama's people, the senior executive service that Obama put in every single executive department. Joe Biden isn't running the country. And the people that are running the country, these are hardcore Marxists. In the words of John Kerry when he was running for president in 2004, America needs to be taken down a peg. This is their ethos. This is what they believe. It's all part of cultural Marxism. People ask, what's cultural Marxism? Well, Marxism is an economic philosophy where the people that control the means of production control the workers, and all the workers have is their labor to trade for money. And Marx was a revolutionary that advocated a proletariat overthrow of the capitalist system, implementing socialism. Well, cultural Marxism uses the same principles, but it applies it to things like religion and society and education.
Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
On the day that he was inaugurated, the Washington Post had an article on impeaching him.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
Donald J. Trump is now president of the United States.
They had an absolute legitimate meltdown.
If you try to change a system that big, the system fights back.
The story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
I actually became infuriated that someone had allowed Zuckerberg to tipped the scale.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided.
This was the greatest billionaire assault on election integrity we've ever seen.
A billionaire-funded plot against the president.
Do you believe that they used the COVID emergency as an excuse to pull this partisan voter turnout operation?
Am I allowed to give you a one-word answer? Yes.
Rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
As Joe Biden negotiates his way out of the room, we don't negotiate with the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Malcolm Roberts Show. My name's Jason Olborn. I'm filling in for Senator Malcolm as we are here with Dr. Philip Altman going through his report, A Time of COVID. Philip.
Thanks, Jason. Well, I think I may have ended up with Malcolm Roberts probably concerning what's happening overseas. And that's really interesting because with respect to these vaccines, there has been an inflection point, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I believe that inflection point has been that Denmark, which has a drug regulator, which is of high quality, they have a reputation that is amongst the top five, equivalent to the Australians, ranks with the Americans and with the UK and with the Dutch, right? Mm-hmm. They're pretty good, and they've looked at the vaccines. And they've recommended just recently that people under 50 years of age don't need to get the COVID-19 vaccines. They've weighed up the efficacy and the risks, and they said no, they don't recommend it. And in the UK, they're not recommending kids under 12 get the vaccine. So this is an important inflection point. And I believe that those sorts of recommendations are going to spread to other countries. How quickly they spread, I do not know. The Australian TGA has not been especially alert to what's happening overseas. I just don't know how they're going to react. But that is certainly the trend. So it's very yes. interesting.
Now, just on that point, just quickly, do you think that when that information comes out, that's substantial information that becomes newsworthy, do you think that at the TGA, and the reason I ask you this is that you have a similar qualification to the head of the TGA, John Skerritt, you've worked with the TGA, so you would be privy to how they think and reason. Do you think that when that Danish news came out that there was a bit of a buzz around the office at the TGA that day going, oh, goodness me, look what's happened in Denmark, those crazy people, why are they doing this? Or this is very interesting. Perhaps we should have a look. Or do they just ignore it altogether and no word is spoken?
Oh, you bet, Jason. You bet. I tell you what, they're right on to it. Okay. They're in daily communication with like regulators across the world. They share a lot of information. And I can tell you that whilst they have always said in Australia, that they make their own decisions, that's decisions with a capital D from a legal mm-hmm. point of view, right? That they will always listen and take recommendations from the US FDA and others. And in actual fact, you know, they write these drug evaluation reports for new drugs, and you can see them online. They've been published. But a lot of that stuff is cut and pasted as well. I think in the very beginning, our TGA and the other drug regulators knew very little about these mRNA vaccines, very little. And they were not prepared to really evaluate these things completely. They had to rely on the advice the companies that were presenting the data. RTGA, as other drug regulators, rely, as some people may or may not know, on external experts. And I know some of these experts, right? They don't have the expertise within the TGA to cover everything. But when you read these OSPAR reports, and they're written very well, very detailed. You can go online and just type in OSPAR, A-U-S-P-A-R, and type the name of the drug in, and you will see the report. Very detailed reports are there. But unless you're a pharmacologist, unless you're used to reading this sort of technical information, it's hard to find your way through this stuff. But I can tell you, RTGA know exactly. If there's a problem with a drug, and I was involved in a case many years ago where a suspected drug that was long used for morning sickness was suspected as causing birth defects. Boy, within hours, we had a meeting with the TGA. They know exactly what's going on.
And this is the drug you're talking about, is thalidomide, of course.
That was the Bendox. That was another drug that the then Sir William McBride was involved in. But I happened to be in charge of the medical department of Merrill Dow that marketed that that preparation at the time. So I know exactly what went on. And the TGA performed incredibly well. They opened up a line of communication with us, and we supplied them with the information, and they have good people. And we were treated very, very fairly. That drug was withdrawn, but not because it was unsafe. It was withdrawn because of the litigation that was pending against the company. Wow. But that was another story.
That certainly is another story. Let's continue again, because we're going to get to a point where I'll bring up more statistics, and I probably should just throw it in now, but 0 to 9, 10 to 19, 20 to 29, the age groups here in Australia, all roughly the fatality rate from COVID in this country is around about 1 in 35,000. So if you're 0 to 29 or any age in between, the general rate is you've only got a 1 chance in 35,000 of dying from the virus. So the question, therefore, is, and this is pointing to Denmark withdrawing approval to give this to under 50s in that country, that there has to be a stage where you have to go risk versus reward. If we've got a fatality rate so minuscule, why would we risk an experimental mRNA technology vaccine on those with the longest life ahead of them to live, when clearly they're all going to survive it? That's the thing that bugs me as a parent more than anything else. But this is a statistic that the TGA still dances around and pretends that it's the same as if you're 75 or 85 and reach life expectancy.
All right, Jason. Well, I should preface what I'm going to say by saying this, that there are games being played with these statistics, right? And the government in Australia and elsewhere has a stated policy, and you can read it. If you go on to the various state reporting websites for COVID-19 stats, they will tell you that they don't distinguish between those dying with COVID and those dying due to COVID, right? Mm. That's very important, because when you have a highly, highly infectious thing and you go to hospital and you're infected with COVID and they can detect even a single virus particle with PCR, that is a positive test. And if you happen to die of a heart attack, that can be listed as a COVID-19 death. So you have to look at all these statistics with a high degree of skepticism, right? The other side of that coin, there's also games being played with the adverse drug reaction reporting, which on from my presentation, which I spent a lot of time on, because the government here is only admitting to 13 quote linked unquote deaths due to COVID-19 vaccine. They're not even admitting that a COVID-19 vaccine caused the death. They're just saying they were linked, which is a wishy-washy way of saying it. But there have been about 900 reports of deaths reported to the TGA. Now, there's an error in that statistics too, right? Because only about 1% of the deaths or the serious adverse events are really reported. In fact, I'm at the intersection of a number of groups, of doctor groups. I speak to doctors on the phone all the time, lawyers. I'm involved in legal cases. And I don't know of a single case of a serious adverse effect that's ever been reported to the Department of Health. Now, having said that, patients can report, family can report, but the reporting system is so cumbersome that they make it difficult to report. And doctors don't like to report. It's very hard. It's hard to speak with a real person on the phone. You usually get a recorded voice. You have forms to fill out. The doctors are busy, and they're a bit scared, right? They don't really want to be reporting these things, to be quite honest. So when the TGA says that there are 900 reported deaths under the DAEN system in Australia, you can multiply that by up to 100 times. That gives you a magnitude of the problem. So every drug has its risks. There's no drug that doesn't have risks, and you should never say that a drug is safe. And our health bureaucrats started off by saying these things were safe and effective, where they had no basis for saying that. They were not fully approved. They were provisionally approved, which means by definition, they have not yet been proven to be safe and efficacious.
Yes.
So
that is,
you know,
that is that, criminal, isn't it?
Well, I can tell you, most of my clients in my career were the multinationals, right? Big multinational companies here, overseas, biotech companies, dealt with all sorts of companies, medical device companies and so forth. I had the odd smattering of smaller clients. And I remember once I had to fly to Canberra to keep one of my clients out of jail because they were a supplement manufacturer who mislabeled some of their product.
Yep.
And if you mislabel a product and you falsely advertise or falsely claim a product does something when it doesn't do it, that's false and misleading activity. And you can have your supplies confiscated, you can be fined, and you can be put in prison for doing that. And I had to fly down to Canberra. I remember it very, very well. And because they knew me, I spoke to some people and I explained the situation and I got the client to change his position in regard to claims because his position was not a realistic one. I had to convince him of that. And it was nip and tuck to keep him out of prison, right? To keep him from being charged. Now, yet our health bureaucrats can go around and say that these things were safe and efficacious when they were only ever provisionally approved. And they're still only provisionally approved. The sponsoring companies have years and years to provide data to justify their continued sale. So this is a real problem.
Oh, it's absolutely unprecedented, really, for the magnitude, the push, all of what we're seeing now is it's frightening, isn't it? When you realise what they've actually been able to get away with and who goes along with it is truly something else. But this is the purpose of what we're doing, and I think in the outcome, in the wash up, if we allow ourselves to think big and look down the track, we are reframing medicine now. for the rest of the 21st century, because they'll never be able to get away with it. The system has to be rebuilt from the ground up. Just watching that movie yesterday, and of course it's a dramatized version of a real story, but just seeing that this doctor goes to the research scientist and gets his support, and as they're talking in the office, the research scientist boss comes in and says, what are you doing? We've got all these other things that you're involved with. And he says, well, I'm working on this. This is very important. He says, you shouldn't be going down this pathway. A little teaching university / hospital like ours shouldn't be doing this. We need money. And so he was compromised at that point. And then later on, when it got hot, the doctor then talked to the research scientist who said, look, my job is done here. I can do no more with this. And she said, hang on a second. People, our patients are dying. This is the most important part of it. And he says, no, I can't do anymore. I've done my job. And so he had been compromised at that point, but hid in his compartmentalized position to be able to justify at his own level that there was no more involvement. He didn't want to get into any more trouble. So this poor lady goes out there on her own and is threatened with prison, threatened with losing a job, threatened with being wiped out by everyone because all she's trying to do is blow the whistle. And this is the point.
That's really interesting that you should mention that. I can mention another movie. I'm an old Peter Sellers fan, right? And I don't know if you ever saw the movie Being There, right?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that one? That was great. For those listeners that have not seen the movie, right? It's an old movie. If you haven't seen it, go get it. It's fantastic. It's about a gardener in New York at the top of a large building, a gardener who became world famous, right? Because he was in the right place at the right time. That was Chauncey the gardener, right?
Yes.
I feel a bit like Chauncey the gardener because I've spent my whole life, you know, in regulatory affairs, doing clinical trials, just squirreling away. And now I'm talking to you, international radio, about my experiences. How did that come about? I mean, that is really, really strange. So I'm Chauncey the gardener, right?
Unreal. And one of the all-time greats was Peter Sellers, and that was one of his most recognized of all films. It's a completely different story. And then you're right. Go catch it. Go catch it. There's nothing quite like it. So we're almost headed into our final break for this hour, and then we've got next hour to go over. But I'll hand you the floor as we continue from Denmark, and we'll put a few more minutes before we take that break.
Sure.
But we do want to be able to go into more of this detail because and this is what's going to happen. I could see this could be a year-long series, Philip, that we could start to pull this apart and be able to compare. But it is wonderful. It becomes a great reference, and I hope at the same time we're providing some really good afternoon listening here in Australia and overnight listening around the world where we are. So back to you.
Right. Well, one of the things that I banged on about at a speech in Melbourne on the 10th of September was about the failure of our adverse drug reaction reporting system.
Hmm.
Now,
yes,
most people don't know about this system, but every country has an adverse drug reaction reporting system. It can be specialized or unspecialized. In the U.S., a lot of people have heard about the VAERS system, V-A-E-R-S system, which is a vaccine-focused, vaccine-centric adverse drug reporting system, right? But, you know, there's adverse drug reaction reporting systems all over the world. They're not very efficient because they're voluntary, right? And they're meant to pick up adverse effects that you don't pick up in the usual development of a new drug. Now, new drugs usually take like 8 to 10 years to develop. And during that those years, billions of dollars are spent and a number of clinical trials are done. Might be 15, 20, 30 clinical trials, right? Which all go to compile the drug dossier to submit to the regulatory authorities for approval. But when you look at it, most of these dossiers only contain probably maybe a few thousand patients, some of them a lot less, some of them a few hundred, right? Depending on circumstances. But if you have a dossier that contains data on, say, 4,000 or 5,000 patients, and you have an adverse drug effect that's popping up, 1 in 5,000, 1 in 10,000, what's the chance of you seeing that during your research and development over those 8 or 10 years, right?
Impossible, yeah.
So you wouldn't see it. So that's why when you have a new drug, especially a breakthrough drug, a new class of drug like these vaccines, especially for that type of situation, you need a really good adverse drug reaction reporting system where people will report everything, not decide whether or not an adverse effect in relation to a particular patient, whether that drug caused that effect or not. You just report it. The job of the ADR system is to then collect all that data, sift through it, and statistically, what pops out is interesting things, rare events that you can find. Sometimes they're not all that rare, right? Now, we have an adverse drug reaction reporting system, DAEN, and it's reporting 13 deaths in relation to these vaccines. 13 deaths.
And all of them are attributed to AstraZeneca still, right?
Well, how can that be?
It's impossible.
How can that be?
Yeah.
It's obviously broken. Now, what I said in Melbourne was, and this was a very important point that I emphasized when I made the presentation, is that we've introduced in Australia what's called a provisional approval system in 2018, which is a shortcut way of getting drugs on the market that are needed in a hurry with limited safety and efficacy data. If you do that, you haven't gone through the 8 or 10 years of looking at these things and collecting the data on thousands and thousands of patients, right? You're relying on the adverse drug reaction reporting system post-marketing to pick up the problems.
Yes.
So we have at the same time a provisional approval system right now that's allowed these gene-based therapies, which the world has never seen before, given to healthy people across the world, irrespective of one's clinical state, whether or not you needed it or not. And at the same time, we have an adverse drug reporting system that is failing to report accurately. It's broken. So, what I basically said was, you have one of two choices. You can either fix the adverse drug reaction reporting system because it is broken. And if you can't fix that, you have to get rid of the provisional approval system. You can't have a provisional approval system which is allowing drugs to skate through, and then you're not picking up the adverse events once they're launched onto the market.
Absolutely. Now, brilliant. That's brilliant. Yeah. Sorry, Philip, just to butt in, we'll take that break. Otherwise, we're going to get lost as we approach the top of the hour, but a whole lot more there. I like that. That is just profound what you've said. And I liken these vaccine reporting systems to basically what it is. It's a check and balance within the system that is user supplied. And really what it's there is to pick up what we would otherwise call the law of unintended consequences. There must be a check in the system. And that is exactly what Philip has pointed out. We're going to take that break now. And we're going to get back into it. It's starting to heat up here in the room. This is TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
In a race critical to GOP hopes of regaining control of the United States Senate next January, former Nevada Attorney General Adam Laxalt is leading incumbent Democrat Senator Catherine Cortez Masto 47-43%, with 4.5% remaining undecided in the latest Trafalgar poll of likely voters. Laxalt, the son of former New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici and grandson of former Nevada Governor and U.S. Senator Paul Laxalt, is seen as one of the GOP's best hopes at flipping a seat from Democrat to Republican. Meanwhile, next door, GOP Senate nominee Blake Masters is reminding Arizonans of Democrat incumbent Senator Mark Kelly's racist joke 4 years ago when he said of his twin brother, former astronaut Scott Kelly, that he was DNA challenged, half a howler monkey, half an orangutan, and that they had changed his name to Rodrigo. Really? Rodrigo? Why Rodrigo? From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
One day, my 8-year-old son, Michael, was playing football with his friends in the mud and got an infection that led to sepsis.
Sepsis is your body's toxic response to an infection that can lead to tissue damage to extremities.
They needed to do 2 upper amputations and 2 below the knee.
Sepsis causes an average of 38 amputations per day in the United States. To learn more, go to sepsis.org.
Democracy is under attack. Western governments are trying to regulate the internet to shut down free speech. Australia and the UK are taking control of their domestic internet. What's next for the US? Lighting the fuse for freedom. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Malcolm Roberts Show. I'm Jason Olborn, filling in for Senator Malcolm, and I'm here with Dr. Philippa Altman, who has just raised the most simple but profound realization of all. We either get rid of provisional approval or we use the DANES, D-A-E-N-S, system of reporting of vaccine and other injuries properly. It's that simple.
Yeah, well, that's the way I see it. And it should be obvious to everyone, because if you look at the vaccine adverse drug reporting systems elsewhere, certainly the VAERS system in the U.S., which collects not only U.S. data, it's mostly U.S. data. It's probably 65 or 70% U.S. data. They do collect some international data as well. But they're reporting 30,000 deaths. Now, if you multiply that by 100, right, you come up with a big number. And even RTGA admit that these adverse drug reporting systems underreport by a factor of between 10 and 20. If you look at the literature, which has been examining this over the last couple years, there is really good evidence to support at least a multiple of 40, an underreporting factor of 40. And really, when you consider everything, including the mindset of doctors and how they are very fearful of their health regulators, I would think that the more accurate underreporting factor is more toward 100. That would be a reasonable sort of assumption. But let me just get back to the observation that you made in the very beginning about Nigeria. Now, sitting and watching the TV here in Australia, and I guess everywhere else, you see epidemiologist after epidemiologist get on the TV and they talk about how serious the pandemic is. Have you ever heard them mention a African country or a country that's done very well, much better than Australia, with a much lower vaccination rate and no lockdowns? They just don't discuss it because the media is controlled, of course, as you and I both know. It's rigidly controlled, and we're not getting the information. This brings me to some huge points, and I guess I'm stepping back, to a position where I'm becoming quite philosophical now, because I'm post-data, right? I mean, when you talk about continuing education in medicine, right, or evidence-based medicine, this now becomes a joke.
Yes.
These basic principles that we have been operating under for many years, and I've just become aware of what's going on. In fact, I was listening in Melbourne when I gave my talk. Pierre Corey, Dr. Corey, had said, and I was sitting there And he said he has just realized how controlled the medical literature is by Big Pharma. And he only became aware of it a couple of years ago. And I tell you what, I felt much better.
Because, is it me? Yes.
You know, now Pierre Corey was not a Big Pharma guy. He's never been a Big Pharma guy. I have been a Big Pharma guy all my life, and I didn't see it. I was feeling really, really bad.
But yes.
Pierre Corey said that, and I must say, I felt better. But that is a fact. And if doctors can't have access to truthful, unbiased information in the literature, and they cannot now. They cannot. I speak to doctors all the time, some very important doctors, very well-qualified specialists. I won't name any names, who have submitted papers. They can't get them published. Because they don't follow the narrative of the government, they simply can't get them into the iconic high-impact medical journals. And this is a tragedy. This makes continuing education a joke. It makes evidence-based medicine a joke. It's happening right now. And then you overlayer that with censorship of the type that this bill is going to produce in Queensland. And it is devastating. Absolutely devastating.
What breaks my heart with all of this is that we have people at the very tippy top of all of it, the soon-to-be, standing down, I should say, Tony Fauci, walking around saying, I am science, trust the science. It's nonsense. Yeah. The science is, they've proven now that it's corrupt. And just for the benefit of the listener who may be tuning in for the first time, Dr. Pierre Corey would have to be the equivalent of Dr. Zelenko in terms of Dr. Corey went to the US Senate and pleaded with them to take on ivermectin as an early treatment plan, just as Zelenko was the master of introducing early hydroxychloroquine in that situation, just to provide you that little bit more perspective. And here we are hearing Dr. Corey realizing that he was discovering, just as Dr. Altman is here, that that the medical profession that they'd worked in for all of their professional lives. Dr. Altman, you've been doing this for 40 years and you're still learning.
Yes, I have. I have. Actually, it's been more than 40 years. It sort of starts to become a disadvantage. Too much experience, right?
But you might become president of the United States in 10 more years' time. There you go.
Well, I have a claim to fame. I have more media coaches than Joe Biden. Mm. My wife is a media coach. My son is a media coach. My daughter is a media coach. All my friends are media coaches, right? I'm not used to speaking on radio like this, but there comes a time when you have to stand up, and everyone has to do whatever they're capable of doing. And I just happen to be in this space. And it's just as important. Those people that marched in Canberra and marched in Sydney and marched in Melbourne and marched in Brisbane by their hundreds of thousands, every one of those people did as much as they could in their own way. And I'm just doing as much as I can in my own way. And Malcolm Roberts is a great supporter of mine, and I get a lot of exposure on TNT radio, and it's just terrific. And I have to tell you that I'm involved in lots of legal cases, right? A lot of people come to me to write affidavits, and I'm prepared to testify in the court. And in all the cases, I keep a running spreadsheet. I have to keep an Excel spreadsheet. The number of cases that I'm involved with, right? And in no case, in not a single case, Jason, have I ever been called to answer a technical question on the vaccines. Not a single question. My evidence has always been accepted because I'm considered to be an expert by the court. I provide my CV and they look at that and they must accept it. But I have never been asked a single technical question. Isn't that amazing?
Extraordinary, but it tells you everything that you need to know in the system today, how everything gets abbreviated and oversimplified. But this should be a case of being asked questions to get more information from, to clarify important points. But what they're automatically accepting, what you're saying verbatim, and that's got to be a good thing, but why are they not wanting to know more? This is a mystery.
It is. And what it boils down to is that the judge or the bench says, well, I have two expert opposing views. I have this view from the government and this view from Altman and McCullough and so forth and so on. And I prefer the view of the government. That's the beginning, middle, and end of the story. And it never gets to a technical question. And those on the other side, all they do is cite the Otagi Task Force.
Here's the news, sorry, Philip.